Welcome to the Half Hour Happy Hour. Your chance to sit back, have a drink, and listen to some insightful musings, funny anecdotes, the occasional rant, and an all-too-frequent Bruce Willis reference. Join Jen, Justin, and Jer in hoisting a beverage or three, picking apart topics of the day and explaining how things came to be the way they are. It's one part educational, one part bacchanal, best served over ice with a healthy dose of wit and a twist of cynicism.
Hi, kids, and welcome to another episode of the Half Hour Happy Hour with your hosts, Jen, Justin, and I'm Jer. Today we'll be discussing literacy by way of books we absolutely love. But first, let's have a beer. Justin, what do you got over there?
From Paulaner, which is in Munich, Germany, I'm drinking an Oktoberfest Marzen. You know, we're coming up on the fall months. The Oktoberfest beer are showing up. And I'm a big fan. I love a good Marzen.
Me too.
They're really good. I could drink. I just have a regular pint glass now. I wish I had a big boot of it.
Versus a pintish glass.
Pintish glass, yeah. No, I'm enjoying it. It's 5.8%. So
I'm going to stop and do an abnormal cheers right now. It's a fall beer season.
Shut up.
Shut up and put them up. And now on to my beer. I'm drinking. What are you giggling about?
Nothing. What have you got, Jen?
Douche.
He feigned interest.
Screw you. I'm going to tell the audience what I'm drinking and not you. So take your headphones off. I'm drinking a Shiner. It's a Bohemian Black Lager. Oh my God, I can't. You gave it to me. I can't talk now.
Communicable.
Shiner, Bohemian Black Lager. Got it. Nailed it. It's good. I like Shiner. They're good. They're not amazing, but they're good. I love how their website says absolutely nothing about the beer. It says that it's rare and unique and complex, but that doesn't say anything.
They all say that.
Well, yeah, and
it's always rare.
But it's not descriptive. It should say complex. When you first put your nose in it, it smells like burnt chocolate and not in the bad way, like toasted chocolate. It's yummy. It doesn't have a particularly strong flavor for being a tarish looking beer. It's black.
It is quite dark.
But it's only 4.9 and it's not a very heavy beer. And you could, I mean, if you like dark beers, you could probably kick back a few of these before you get that misnomer full feeling. But
so my beer has more alcohol than both of yours combined. 10%.
Tell us all about it, Jer.
Dogfish Head. Burton Baton. It's an aged oak Imperial Indian Pale Ale. But it's actually interesting. It's brewed as an old English style ale and as an IPA. Does the fermentation thing, then they blend it and put it into oak casks.
They mix them separately and then
can mix them with just the right. It's delicious. Huh. It's off the charts amazing. But on the bottle, please share it with loved ones and hoard it from the non-believers.
Amen to that.
Huge fan. On the website, even better. After they've transferred the two together and blended them into one of their large oak tanks, Burton Baton sits on the wood for about a month. I couldn't help but find that funny. I don't know who Burton Baton is.
But thank you.
But thank you.
We love your gay beer. Sorry, should I not have gone there?
No. Okay. No, look at the picture on the bottle.
No, okay, wait. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a dude with his legs crossed on a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting on the wood for a month.
He really is.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's delicious, though. Well played, Dogfish Head.
And the Dogfish Head marketing team. Yep.
So, raise them up.
Again.
Okay, so I got something cool for you guys that I saw a couple of days ago. It's this video that shows a new method of boarding an airplane that cuts the time in half that it takes to get onto the airplane.
They open the back and let you connect from both sides.
I wish. I hate wasting time. I hate when stuff is
slow. Or that's what she said.
Thank you. I had a finger cuffs joke in my head that was killing me.
So they're coming in from both sides, or he hates when things go slow? I claim a double that's what she said score.
A
on
double
that
double
one.
Entendre.
Yeah. Yes.
The quad.
Speaking of the dirty quad, how do you get on a plane from the wrong side?
So this new method of getting on the plane involves they board from the windows first, alternating sides. And then, you know, once those are full, you know, move to the middle seats and then the outer seats. So they show the video that'll be on the website shows them boarding and, you know, people come down. You have like three people are putting their stuff away and getting out at a time because they're all window seats at different parts of the aisle on one side.
Right.
So then the next side comes in and they're free to just move back and go to their seats and so on. And it's pretty... pretty impressive.
It makes perfect sense. I misunderstood initially. I thought they were loading from the window. No. Like those are emergency exits.
Different boarding procedure.
Gotcha.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Yeah, but people are going to freak out because that means the person that you're sitting next to. So like if the three of us are traveling together, we're going to be getting on the plane at totally different times.
That's fine.
Yeah, but people are going to freak out because they're sheep and they're stupid.
Well, or they're parents with children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, there are a couple of hiccups, I grant. But if you've got one family boarding on one row while everybody else is doing their thing,
then you
you go ahead and let that row fill up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's easy enough to do.
Right.
Meanwhile, the douchebags in first class are still sipping their champagne.
Don't they do the parents traveling with small children get on first anyway? Like, wouldn't that just be standard
practice?
Oh, that's
true. Uh-huh. True.
Yeah, it's parents with children get on first. Yep.
Right on.
Yep. Women and children first.
So... I hope, you know, I'll be interested to see.
They should start that announcement. They should get on the... No?
No.
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 No screaming bomb in the airport. Got it.
Okay. I'll be interested to see what airlines start picking this up because why not?
Do you know who did this study?
The government.
No. It was some engineer who just... Some guy who came up with this method.
It sounds like an engineer's idea.
Yeah.
It sounds like an engineer who has to travel a lot.
Yes.
Yep.
So, I could totally do this better.
Oh, yeah.
Sketched it out on the flight.
Trying to explain it to people next to him.
Getting on the plane sucks. I hate waiting for stuff.
Yes.
Especially when there's no, why aren't you moving? There's no reason to not
statement
be
of our generation. Well, I hate waiting for stuff.
Yep. Section 2 now boarding, which means section 3, 4, and 5 all stand up and start queuing, blocking the entrance for people in section 2. It's a pain in the ass. It's a really piss poor system.
So, an entire show about bitching about air travel, soon to follow, I'm sure. Wow.
So, what else? What else do we got?
Jen?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I can top a plane boarding from both sides. Giggity. I do actually have a really interesting article kind of following up on our education, mobile education. This is an article from Mindshift, which I love. It's an education website kind of thing. And it's 6 reasons why kids should know how to blog. And just to skim through it really fast, like, kids are going to have to be... Yeah, I know you're looking at me, and I did the same thing.
I'm wondering what they're going to write.
We want our students to be able to have a handle on digital tools and how to communicate, not through just, like, networks like Facebook. You want to be able to have kids to establishing positive digital impressions of themselves, because that's going to be so important. I mean, we're pioneering it. And I think, Funk, you and I have had this conversation many times about how, like, social media is degrading our society and the way we interact with people because... people say such crass things when you don't have to look at the other person.
It's a tool that's being poorly used.
Exactly. So teaching our kids to create a positive digital image of themselves, I think is, it never occurred to me. I was like, why should kids blog?
That was twice you said positive.
Positive? Whatever. Positive.
It's a word. Look it up.
I keep reading and it's positive digital right next to each other. It's positive.
Positive.
Yes. Just understand me, okay?
Contraction.
Lord. Anyway, like how to use certain networking tools that aren't necessarily social media, but other ways. It's allowing parents to interact with your kids on a different level. Like kids blog for homework assignments about what they had to do in school and what they learned. You not only get the kid's impression of this is what I learned and this is what I took from it, but then the parent can go back and read in their kid's words what they're learning, what interests them. And it encourages the parents to interact that much better, that much easier.
I wonder if it's just going to be like the teacher stinks and Billy flicked a booger at me and...
No, like it's not going to be a report on what happened at school. That's kind of lame. But like to assign reports as blogs. I mean, how much if your teacher looked at you and said, you don't have to write this massive book review, but I want you to blog every, you know, chapter. I don't even know. Like it doesn't give examples on how they're using it. Or instead of writing like a full report and standing up in front of the class and reading it, you blogged it in sections.
I like that idea because it pulls them out of that structured way of approaching it and lets them do it. If they want to write an essay style, they can. If they want to just write their thoughts on it, they can do that.
It can be as free form as they want it to be.
No, I like that.
It's individual to each student, which is nice.
Yep. Exactly. And it's encouraging, like I said, like that positive presence. It's encouraging them to use the tools around them that they're going to have to use. And this was my favorite clip. effective digital citizenship. By creating portfolios or digital collections of their work, our students learn how to conduct themselves in digital spaces in the context of their curriculum, not just in isolated lecture-style presentations that may strike a chord with some students. I really... effective digital citizenship.
This is like wonderful because I've got the worst segue ever into my next story.
Do mm-hmm. it.
State Senator from Orlando, Florida, just handed out 200 belts because he got the, and I quote, pull your pants up law passed last year. So now all these kids that are doing these wonderful blogs, yeah, they've got new belts. All thanks to this state senator.
Chair, that sucks.
They can concentrate. Honest to God, we have a senator who's dealing with, he thinks the biggest problem the state of Florida has is seeing a kid's underwear.
This reminds me of Dennis Leary's opening rant for No Cure for Cancer, where he's like, there's some guy in Britain that wants to make the warnings on the packs bigger, as if we didn't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and my thought was, reading this article, why not just make dress codes mandatory in public schools?
Right. They're doing that in most schools anyway.
Yeah.
At least a lot of the lower ones.
I'm not okay with this.
Whatever.
Why?
I understand all the social like the reasons and to make like uniformity to eliminate discrimination.
It's the next step in the school process. It's
yeah but
uniform
I don't
education,
like,
uniform people.
I don't like the school process. Well, and I don't like the fact that you wouldn't
be
allowed.
Yeah, we did a whole show on that.
Down to the fact that they're like, I see being a girl and being judged for what granted, I look back at what I wore in sixth grade and go, oh, Jesus, really? But I think we all did that to a certain extent, but yeah. I was brutalized, as most girls were, and I'm sure you have a similar experience, and I don't think I would take that back, because I got to wear whatever I wanted, and I wanted to be a little weird, and that was cool with me. Well, and I would never want that ability to be taken away from me.
Well, now you'd have to wear a belt, so your underwear wasn't showing.
I didn't show my underwear.
Actually, and bare midriffs are out too, but he didn't buy anything for the ladies exposing their bellies. Don't know why.
That's a shame. So I've got another one. Occasionally I will, you know, have moments in my life where I wonder, you know, am I really making a difference? Am I doing something valuable? You know, how do I stack up to the rest of the world?
And then you say no, and you go back to playing video games.
There's a 46-year-old Swiss man, Freddie Knock, tight walked up a 1,000-meter cable car rope that goes up the 9,000-foot summit of Bavaria's Zugspitz Mountain with no pole or harness. He just tightrope walked up this cable.
9,000 feet, you said?
It goes up 9,000 feet. The cable is 1,000 meters long. No, 9,000. The mountain's 9,000. Yeah, 9,000 feet.
Okay. Wow.
So he got bored one day and was like, screw it.
So I was sitting around like having an existential, like, what am I doing with my life? And then I read this and I'm like, okay, you know, I guess it takes all kinds. So I'm all right.
Where was that?
It was the Bulgarian mountains. So
oh, okay.
Swiss man in Bulgaria doing a
interesting
epic tight rope walk.
Positive.
Tight rope walk.
Well, the tricky part of that though is he's going uphill.
Right.
I don't think I'd be worried about the uphill. I think I'd be worried about the downhill.
Oh no! Yeah,
the downhill. The uphill would probably be easier if you kept a good pace.
No.
No.
The rope is slacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't walk it if it was slacked.
It has to be slacked. I watched a guy in the Bahamas doing it from one tower to another tower, and it was going to be one of the longest straight rope things. But they showed he had a 30% incline on the way back up from the middle.
Yeah, it's always you can't get it perfectly straight, rope.
But 30 degrees
over 1,000 meters, it had to have support poles in between, so it's going to slack. It's right. Not going to be a straight.
Could be. I'm just saying.
So he could just like, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but those mountains are going to be icy, correct?
Cold, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. He's going to like slide down and then have to haul ass and then slide down and haul ass.
It'd be fun.
But he could totally like maybe Silver Surfer down it.
There you are.
On the way out. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Well, in Bonn, Germany, they've just solved one of those crazy problems we have here and nobody does anything about. Taxing hookers.
Okay.
There's now just like a parking meter.
Parking meter
on the street corners.
I kid you not. The hookers have to get a ticket.
Oh, that is brilliant.
They have to basically because it's perfectly legal in Bonn, and so they in this one section they've like sectioned off a section of town, put up rudimentary parking garages, you know, for
giggity.
Exactly. But
best
yeah.
giggle ever, Funk.
No, this is brilliant. This is one of the best ideas I've heard in a long time.
Well, and that's it. So they have to every couple hours or whatever go back to this meter and.
So do the cops come by? Have you ever seen the cops tagging the tires of the cars? Right. Do they do that?
You
to the
said
hose?
Tagging too many times for me to be okay with that statement. Like, bitch, you didn't especially pay your ticket. The, bend over.
You're getting tagged.
But yeah, I thought that was a pretty ingenious.
And when he's done, he licks the ticket and sticks it to her ass.
Oh, that's great.
I'll see you in a couple hours.
You can work that off, you know.
You just got to sit on some wood for a while.
Bringing it back around.
Very well, well played, sir. Well played.
So anything else good or?
I want to share this because I think it's awesome.
Okay.
I just discovered this sitting outside talking to Jer. It's called the iVictrola. And it is a non-electric sound amplifier. It is a grand. It is $1,000. I'm starting with that. I'm leading with that. So I'm going to build your expectations of what could possibly be worth a grand. It is a chunk of walnut wood that you set your iPad in. And your iPad, which doesn't have tremendous speakers, because I mean, really, that's not what it's for. Plugs into the bottom without any electricity.
It doesn't plug into the bottom.
It has to plug into the
bottom. No, the speakers are in the bottom. It pushes the speaker noise through a tube.
All right, well, whatever. It sits in the walnut. We're not sure how it works, obviously. It sits in this
but
walnut
it requires no power.
Brick. It requires absolutely no electricity, and it comes through this antique Magnavox phonograph horn. So literally, it is a block of wood with a phonograph horn, and you set your iPad in it, and it apparently is pretty epic sound.
I mean,
how sexy is that?
That's pretty cool.
A grand.
Huh. No, you can't say then.
It
that ruins
does.
The effect.
I mean, it does look like it. I mean, it obviously doesn't plug into it, but it is just like a dock. I mean, it looks like a docking station, so. Huh.
Well, where are the speakers on the iPad?
They're at the bottom. Screw you, Jer.
Yeah. So it just plays through there.
So
it
works
like
a phonograph.
Yeah,
does.
It works
just
exactly
like
one.
Which makes it even sexier. Yeah. I want one of these.
A grand. It's more than the iPad.
Can want.
You could
whatever.
Probably make that for a fraction of the price.
Well, and if you didn't have an antique Magnavox phonograph horn, it wouldn't cost that much.
True.
Which means they're going to have knockoff ones available soon.
We'll go get you a big orange cone inverted.
I have one in the garage.
There you go. That would work.
Oh, I almost said where it was from, but that city would be very upset with me if I told them. I also have blue handy cones. They're traffic cones, but they're blue with the white stripe instead of orange with the white stripe. So I call them my handy cones because they're handicapped cones.
Okay.
Like
the cones themselves are handicapped, or
or the person that took them, or they happen to be in the handicap zone, or all three. You figure it out.
Okay. All right. So let's get a beer.
Sounds good.
So I'm going to take this lovely restful moment in between segments while the boys go fetch me a nice cold beer, sprawl out on the couch, and tell you a little bit about more where you can find me. More Jen, because everybody needs... All right, fine, you can find them too. Jer, Justin, and Jen all together on thehalfhourhappyhour.com, facebook.com/thehalfhourhappyhour, or find us on Twitter if you have mad ADD at thehhhh. So thanks for listening, guys. And my beer arrives, so back to the show.
All right, so we're back. We're talking about books this week. We all like to read. We think reading is an important part of every young adult's life.
Young.
Well, I guess we're not really young adults anymore. But I mean, that's when everybody. Yeah, an important part of everybody's life. Yes, you're correct. So we're going to share with you some of our favorite books. Some of the books that we love the most. Me personally, I have, you know, I've got a very pretty strict taste. I like a lot of sci-fi, and I tend to find a few series that I like and then I go back to them. A lot of the series that I've read several times. And I also like long series. I don't generally like to read just one book. Once I get into something, I want to read a bunch of it. So like I've read the Dune series a couple of times. That's like six books long. The Ender series I think I've only read that one once. But
did you do both once it split?
No, I only Ender read like Bean? The first four of the Ender, just up through.
I've got the Bean ones.
Yeah.
I'll hook you up.
I've heard they're good. I just haven't had the time to get into them.
They're actually, after the original Ender book, they are probably as good, if not better, than the Ender series.
Okay.
So,
cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I also do branch out from the sci-fi on occasion. I like books that kind of take the concept of a deity and kind of humanize and personify. I know there's a term for that, actually, and I can't think of what it is off the top of my head.
Embody?
No, I think it's longer than that.
Oh, sorry.
No, I don't remember. And I might be wrong. There might not be a word for it. But so books like Good Omens, you know, that's a good book.
Terry Pratchett does
that kind of thing. Also, American Gods is a great book that does that kind of thing. And I think, Jen, you've read American Gods too, right?
Yeah, you know, once or twice.
Yeah.
American Gods is actually my favorite book, period. I mean, my mood will fluctuate quite a bit depending, like, they'll be very close runners to it. But I think American Gods is my favorite book ever.
Well, I read it because you recommended it to me, and it was a fantastic book.
Yeah.
And then while I was reading it, they announced they were going to make a movie.
Right, exactly. They're making a movie. Yeah.
So to both of you, you're welcome. To the audience, you're futurely welcome.
Yep.
Absolutely.
It is an absolutely amazing book. Neil Gaiman, depending on how you say it. I like Gaiman, so I'm going to go with that. Shit.
You like gay men, so you're gonna go with that.
We're gonna tag him in the show notes anyway.
That is actually not a problem. That's I going have on in my a, love life.
That's going on a t-shirt someday.
All right, listen, if we make it way big, I will rock that t-shirt.
Anyway.
Wow, I'm gonna get one of those 80s t-shirt ties to put on it too, because okay. I'm amazing. Side ponytail. It's gonna happen. So personification, is that the word you were looking for earlier?
No.
Whatever. Okay. So the premise of American Gods is that these mythological creatures exist because we believe in them.
Right.
So coming to America, American Gods, all of these immigrants brought all of their old gods, all of their old beliefs to America. And it's become like, you know, and they all exist. Like you've got the Norse gods and you've got like leprechauns and you've got like everything all blended together in the great melting pot that is the U.S.
The salad.
Yeah, we can't say melting pot. I'm sorry. I'm so on PC. Because that's my goal in life is to be PC.
Get those tomatoes out of my shit.
Yeah, wow. That might
not come out right.
No. Especially if there's still raw tomatoes in there. So, oh, that was awesome. Okay, so anyway, the neat thing about this is like, okay, so now you've got all these neat gods, but they start picking up and they start reflecting our values like of current US situation. So like they become obsessed with like the media and celebrityism and technology, drugs, all sorts of interesting things. So imagine all these like these stories that you learned as a kid about mythology and imagine that those gods with their same personality traits exist now as like actual entities
mm-hmm.
and they're in our culture.
Right.
So it's freaking awesome.
Yep.
So that's kind of how the book evolves. That's kind of like the main premise. But the protagonist, the good guy, for those of you playing the slow game, the protagonist is this shady bastard. His name is Shadow. His name is Shadow.
Yep.
And he is released from jail at the beginning of the book. And shit just goes downhill for this dude. I mean, it's an amazing story. You kind of aren't sure if you're rooting. Like, you kind of want to not root for him because you feel like you shouldn't, but you do because he's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I love Odin.
Yeah. I'm always a big fan of the Norse gods are my favorite.
The Norse people were brutal. Yeah. So their gods are freaking brutal.
Yep.
Loki's my favorite. Not in the book. Like, in Norse mythology, Loki's my favorite because he is a tricky bastard. Mm-hmm. You know, like to carry on certain admirable personality traits. .. Anyway, yeah, you all should read American Gods. I'm not going to go too much into it because I can't start talking about the book without giving a lot of shit away.
Definitely not want to spoil it or anything like that.
It is truly amazing. Wednesday's amazing. I love him. Shadow's great. And you need to read this book. And you also, if you like this book, you should read everything Neil Gaiman ever did.
Because
you'll love Gaiman too.
Right. No, Gaiman, he is a great author. You know, Good Omens, that was Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. Neverwhere, I've read Neverwhere, is great.
Yeah.
Also, you're welcome.
Uh-huh.
I haven't actually read enough any of his other ones. Anansi Boys, I haven't read.
Anansi Boys is actually the sequel to American Gods. It doesn't.
It's a more spiritual successor.
It pales in comparison. Oh, okay. Like,
is it a direct sequel, though?
The Apocrypha, kind of Gaiman?
No, I mean, it's still a good read, but when you come from this book, and I reread American Gods before I read A Nasty Boys, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, balls, just balls. Like, but that wasn't fair, because I was reading in the context of my favorite book ever, which is kind of a hard act to follow.
Right.
Neverwhere is an amazing book. It's actually, the back cover of Neverwhere says it's like a dark Alice in Wonderland, and that's what made me pick it up and start reading it, and I believe that Neverwhere was my first Gaiman book that I read. Of course, Gaiman writes Sandman, so I've been reading his shit for years. It was kind of one of those moments that I didn't even know he wrote books. And then, just like you, like once I find something I like, I latch onto it, because to find a good book nowadays is difficult.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm one of those people where I like to buy books if it looks good. Like, you know, and I read a little bit and it looks good. But if I get through the first chapter or two and I'm not like, feed me more, I put the book down and never touch it again. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a very expensive habit.
Actually, it was something I was thinking about earlier. Does anybody here at the table have an ebook reader?
I have the Kindle app on my phone, and I love it.
Okay, but would you actually consider upgrading to an ebook reader?
No.
And then Jen has an iPad too,
which I never use as a reader. Ever.
Really? Okay.
I like websites and stuff, but never as a book reader.
I use my phone quite extensively as a reader.
Interesting.
And I see no need to upgrade to a reader. I read fine on that. Some people will say, oh, well, the screen's so small. Yeah, but it's...
You turn pages more frequently,
but it reads fine. I mean, it's...
It just occurred to me. I was literally walking through the library at my house looking for the books that I love most to read. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, it would be really convenient to have all these digitized someplace where I could read them real small.
Yep.
And then I started thinking about it. And aside from the iPad, too, I couldn't think of anything that we had digital between the three of us.
We're kind of geeky. I recently, you know, I took a break off of reading for a bit, and then I got back into it. I've been reading Asimov, so I've got a lot of his stuff on my phone. Going through the Robot series, Foundation series. Unfortunately, the third Robot book isn't on Kindle format yet, so I haven't been able to read that one. But
I find that very interesting that you had that. You're walking through your library, because JR's library, you actually do have to walk through. You're walking through your library trying to think of books that you want to talk about, and you think to yourself, wouldn't I love to have this in a digital format, when you and I were always opposed to
It's just much more convenient.
Yeah. That's not my argument. I'm not saying that carrying a book around in my bag that weighs my shoulder down is a pain in the ass, especially some of the books that I read.
Realistically, what I was looking at was, like, I own a significant number of volumes from certain authors,
mm-hmm.
none of whom actually made the cut for best book. And so when you actually look at the books I own versus what I would consider my favorite books, for example, Orson Scott Card has probably six different series of books I'm in the middle of, all of them.
Hmm.
Fantastic author. Kurt Vonnegut, everything he ever wrote. To have me pick a book would be painful. Robert Heinlein, same thing. And so,
I just read Stranger in a Strange Land for the first time not too long ago.
Isn't his best book.
No, not at all.
I compare Stranger to a Strange Land to Full Metal Jacket. It really should have ended when they got out of...
Yeah,
and then it just kept going on for like an additional 25.
I definitely know it.
Heinlein wrote the book to
Starship Troopers, that's
which is
go
one of
with
the
it.
Best books you
I've
will ever
heard
read
the book is,
oh it's
I enjoyed the movie and I heard oh, the book the, is the, way better
the movie is the sad shadow that exists behind a book that is actually incredible on umpteen different levels.
Yeah. Huh.
But yeah, very impressive. Stephen Hunter owned a bunch of his books. Shout out to Bob Lee Swagger. But ultimately, I've got a bunch of books from a bunch of authors, and really none of them made the cut.
Hmm.
So it would have been nice to have an iTunes kind of app to go, well, what have you read the most?
Right.
What have you, like, just because I own every book they've ever put out,
mm-hmm.
how many of those have I gone back and reread?
Reread, yep.
And that was really the measure I used.
Yep. So what's on your list?
Actually, number one was a no-brainer, Daniel Quinn, Ishmael. It is a series, it's a trilogy, and in some cases you could argue more. It's kind of like the Hitchhiker's Guide in that regard. It was actually started off as a 600-page treatise that he shortened to win the Turner Tomorrow Fellowship Award as an author. Brilliant book. If you were to... One of the best descriptions on the back of the dust jacket, you know, they always ask for people to quote and whatever. Mm-hmm. One of the quotes was, I now categorize everything I read into two sections. Ones I read before Ishmael and ones I read after.
Okay.
The book will literally deconstruct everything you think you know down to bare bones and leave you there a sniveling child.
What kind of book is it?
It's fiction.
Okay.
I'm not willing to call it fiction. It's a fictional representation of facts.
That's called fiction.
No, it's not. It's not the same as fiction.
Is it like National Treasure, where it's like real stuff but it's fictionalized? Like
no, it's almost like it's like an anti parable.
Okay.
Okay. So he has a bunch of facts. He's got a lot of information to throw at you, and he puts it into a way that's so simplistic that if you try to over-intellectualize it, you'll lose.
Okay.
And if you try to under-intellectualize it, you'll lose. And so you just have to let it tear you down. And it's awesome because I've given this book away probably a dozen plus times. I literally do not own a copy of it anymore. I've given away 12 of them because it's such a good book.
Gotta get it digital.
Gotta get it digital. I gave it to a guy and I warned him about it. I was like, look, I know you well enough. I think you're ready for this kind of book. It's really going to mess with your head. No. And we all know this guy because we just did a photo shoot with him. And I get a phone call about 2 weeks later going, dude, that is the best book I have ever written. And fuck you. Sorry. My fault. I did that. But it's a direct quote because he was literally left standing naked in the rain going, if the world isn't what I think it is, then what the hell is it? And that's what it takes you back to. It literally strips all the illusions away and leaves facts in front of you, and you cannot argue the facts.
Hmm. Interesting.
Wonderful book.
Might have to read it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be naked in the rain, Daddy.
Oh, come on. And then the other book, Bruce Chatwin, is just a favorite author of mine. He's kind of in the vein of Vonnegut and Hemingway, but he was a world traveler. Died young, but he wrote a book called The Songlines, which studies Aboriginal culture, but not from an ethnographic perspective per se, but from I want to be a part of the world. Like, I want to be a citizen of the world, not just, in his case, a UK citizen. Mm-hmm. He just filled up books and books and notebooks of stories and things that he had while he was traveling around through Australia, and came up with this book, and it just follows Aboriginal culture and how things work. So those were my two.
Interesting. So mine, I think my favorite book of all time, my favorite series, has got to be the Hitchhiker's Guide series. If anybody listening to this, if you have not read the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
go away.
You have to read it. I'd be surprised if anybody who's listening to this show, you know, anybody who we've attracted, has not read it. But if you haven't, shame on you.
A trilogy with 5.5 books.
5.5 books, yeah. Brilliant. Read all of them. And it's so much like, you know, the central concept, 42, is like I view that as my religion. That's the embodiment of agnosticism, as far as I'm concerned, is the question and the answer are mutually exclusive. You can't know both. That's agnostic. That's what it is. So I really identify with that.
Shortly after I met Funk, I discovered that he has a tattoo. Can I tell him what your tattoo
is?
It is a Legend of Zelda tattoo. It's the crest from the shield of the Ocarina of Time, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I can't believe I knew all that. Shortly after I found that out, he told me he wanted a second tattoo. I think he's given up on this idea, which is sad. But he wants 42 tattooed in binary on his forearm. Somewhere. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, I would give total props to that.
And then for my last tattoo, he told me I was getting too old for tattoos. So I'm kind of like, screw that guy now.
Well, what about The Dirk Gently?
I haven't read anything outside of the Hitchhiker series. So I need to.
Next time we record, I'm bringing like a backpack full of books.
I've heard Dirk Gently is good. I need to read that.
It is.
But so outside of Douglas Adams, my personal favorite author is Werner Vinge. He's a sci-fi author. He's what's considered hard sci-fi. He was a computer science professor at San Diego State University until 2004.
Which means the fact that he can write books that other people can read at all is impressive.
Yeah. but no, it's, you know, I love his stuff because it's good sci-fi. it also gets a little bit into the, you know, technical, how, like, kind of tries to ground it in reality. So his explanations of the way things work are realistic. And I found on occasion, like, it'll give me an idea. Like, some of his concepts are like, ooh, that'd be so cool if, you know, that kind of system would work or whatever. So, but he's got a bunch of stories. Some of his more popular ones are The Peace War, and there's a couple of books in that series, but basically that centers around they invent this technology that lets them create bubbles that basically freeze they're impenetrable bubbles that freeze everything inside of them in space and time for, you know, an extended period of time, millions of years we're talking. So some of these books take place, you know, these societies are being encased in these bubbles and then passing through like millions of years of time on Earth. So they get to see like the way things change. It's really interesting stuff, the way they approach it. And then, you know, two of his more well-known books are A Fire Upon the Deep, and then what's more or less a prequel of that, A Deepness in the Sky. And these are set in, it's the concept of a galaxy, and the way this galaxy works is your technology level, your capacity for power is determined by how far from the galactic core you are. So it's like, you know, information density, you know, when you're close to the core, it's not really, you know, you have like basic level of technology. But once you get out, you've got anti-gravity and super fast systems and that kind of stuff. And then once you get outside of the actual galaxy itself, you know, transcend to some higher being, things like that. Mm-hmm. So Fire Upon the Deep starts off where humans find this ancient million-year-old data lab that's kind of like right on the boundary of the transcendent. And they wake up this, you know, ancient evil program that takes things over. But he's really good. Both of his stories, Fire Upon the Deep and Deepness in the Sky, they kind of follow two parallel stories. There's always, you know, one group of people is doing one thing and the other one is doing the other thing at the same time. So while you've got this kind of high technology space race going on, you've also got these survivors who have crash landed on this planet that is populated by these dog wolf-like creatures that are pack minds, so that when like four or five of them to come together, they form a consciousness and work like that.
Which
so
is really difficult to read. That's the one I gave up on. That's the first one he gave me, and like trying to separate initially, like first you have to figure out, because he doesn't explain it to you right away.
Right.
Trying to figure out why all these thoughts are going through this crazy person's mind, and then you realize that you're thinking for five people right now. It's really like, I don't like this guy.
No, and actually like I He's got a new book coming out in October, Children of the Sky, which is a sequel to A Fire Upon the Deep.
But it doesn't have the word deep in it.
Which I'm really excited about. But anyway.
Which part? Anyway.
That the sequel's coming out. But I went back and started rereading A Fire Upon the Deep to get prepared for it. And I had that, going through the first couple of chapters, I had that thought like, wow, I'm glad I've read this before and I don't know how I got to it at the beginning because... like, it's up there.
Funk has given me this book several times, and I've asked for it a couple times. Like, I really want to try to get through it because your bookshelf is like half Werner Vinge.
Yeah, it really is. I love his stuff.
Really? So I'm like, Jared and I share books often. Like, yeah. I value other people's input because, as I said, it's hard to find a good book. But that's the first one you gave me, and I'm like, I'm going to get through this freaking book. But you get to the first couple chapters, and you're like, I have no idea who the characters are, who is what in what mind. Like,
you might need to
start with a different one.
A Deepness in the Sky is, it's the prequel to that one. He wrote it after. It takes place before. It's very, very loosely coupled. And it's arguably much better written. It's a lot easier to follow. So maybe you need to read that one. That one centers around, there's this star that goes through these phases to where it'll be on for 50 years and then turn off for like 50 years. So there's a planet that's inhabited by these spider creatures who, you know, have to burrow for 50. They're intelligent. They have to burrow and hibernate for 50 years. And then they come out and build their civilization, all that kind of stuff. And then there's humans who come along, two different groups of humans who come along to try to exploit whatever they're going to find. And there's some conflict there, but that one's actually really well written also. It's a little,
he attempt to explain the science behind why the sun turns on?
No, not really, because they're that's part of what they're doing there, is trying to figure out. It's actually more, it's a lot more about social dynamics, because it focuses on these two different human groups. There's like one there's the trader group, and then there's another one that's almost like cultish. So they come together, there's a power struggle, and then they've got to integrate these two cultures. So you've got that kind of stuff. And then the main character, who's a badass, like just an old like grifter kind of smooth Han Solo type character. So it's pretty good stuff. You'll have to try that one first. It's an easier read.
Way to explain that in advance.
Yeah. So
fail.
But no, Werner Vange, if you're into the hard sci-fi, which I know not a lot of people are, but if you are, he's the best out there. So
build a world and live in it.
Build a world and live in it. And he does an excellent job of doing that. So yeah, so those are mine. I guess the one takeaway is Hitchhiker's Guide, if you couldn't. If you haven't read that one, you got to read that one.
But. Yeah.
I have another one. Do we have enough time?
Yeah,
yeah, go ahead.
So I had a favorite book picked out, and I changed it because you guys were sitting there talking about these epic like authors. And I guess now that I think about it, Roald Dahl, Matilda was the other book I was going to talk about because I think it really kind of applies to our education system.
I've never read Matilda.
Neither have I.
Oh, well, balls. Maybe I should talk about Matilda. Okay, well, I will talk about Matilda then. And now I'm going to have to find that information again because I closed that window, but that's okay. Roald Dahl is amazing. And I'm going to list a couple of his books just because you will be listening and go, oh, I love that one, a couple times. Gremlins, James and the Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, The Magic Finger.
These are books?
Yes, these are children's books.
Because these are movies that I like also.
Fantastic Mr.
Gremlins,
Fox.
Gremlins, James and the Giant Peach. Fantastic Mr. Fox is good. I saw the movie.
Danny the Champion of the World, The Enormous Johnny Crocodile, The Twit, The BFG, and one of my favorites, The Witches. But Matilda was always my favorite. The story of Matilda is basically like, it's a neglected child. She's if her parents would pay attention to her.
Because that's always a good story.
If her it's a story of overcoming. Shut the hell up, Funk.
We love a tale of neglected children around here.
It is the story of a neglected girl who, if her parents paid attention to her, they would realize she's a child prodigy. She taught herself to read by three. Like, she's a brilliant kid. And her parents are total douchebags. Her dad's a used car salesman, fills tanks with sawdust and rolls the odometer back and all this other fun stuff. You know, she gets old enough to, she begs her parents for books and her dad tells her to shut up and go turn on the TV. Her parents are just so disinterested in their children. And she is just brilliant, craves knowledge, starts sneaking off to the library. Eventually, like, she reads the entire children's section and they give her a library card. She starts sneaking home books. Her parents find them, get pissed. She decides that she's going to correct her parents every time they do something wrong. So she starts pulling these brilliant pranks. And when you're reading this as a kid, you're like, she's my hero. Like, talking bird up the chimney to scare them, like just little interesting things. Eventually she starts going to school and her teacher is very sympathetic. Her teacher's name is Miss Honey, and Miss Honey is, you know, the next level of authority. The authority above that, the principal, is Miss Trunchbull, who is basically like a big, angry Scottish looking dyke in my mind. Like, I just see her in a kilt and like bobby socks and like, you know, a giant like puffed out chest. Like, she just looks mortifying to me in my head. And of course, it's the same image that I had when I read it as a kid. But anyway, so this kid goes to school and she's brilliant. And her teacher really recognizes this in her and wants to encourage her to learn and grow and whatever else. And the principal, who is obviously not representative of a school principal, but more the education system, as I'm looking at this, mm-hmm. is just very oppressive. Like, do it the way everybody else does it. Shut up. Don't make noise. Don't make trouble. It's a really, really brilliant story. Of course, then at that point, Matilda realizes that she has some sort of like kinetic abilities and she can move things by concentrating on them, which is where the story kind of goes a little kiddish. But I mean, it's good because you need a hero at that point when you're a little kid. Mm-hmm. But I'm reading this book like I'm the nerdy kid who loves to read. Like, do you remember the pan pizza program at Pizza Hut where if you read so many books, like, you got free pizza all the time? Like, Book It. That's what it was called. Book It. Yeah, Jerry, you're too old.
I get that a lot.
I got a shit ton of free pizza because, like, and all the other kids would bitch about it or their parents would lie about the books that they read. And I'm like, I read this stack. So for me to be a gifted girl growing up who loved to read, it was a really good hero for me to have, a really good protagonist. And I've always kind of kept that book close to me. And I've actually recommended it to, you know, my sister when she was growing up, my cousin when she was growing up. It's a good story for what it is. But now that I kind of step back and I was thinking about what are my favorite books, and the education topic comes up because it's a reoccurring topic for me, because not only is it a passion, but a field that I work in. that I really think that this story kind of transcends the individual and goes into the whole system. And I think
it sounds like it.
I think that our educators, all levels, especially the bureaucratic educators, if there is such a thing, because I'm pretty sure that's an oxymoron. like your peace wars. I tried really hard not to make a comment about that. I was like, that is the stupidest title for shit ever. Anyway, read the book and encourage kids to learn in ways that they want to learn. Yay.
While you were talking, it occurred to me, Shel Silverstein.
It was amazing. Incredible.
Okay. I was just thinking, no idea?
No idea.
What? Where the sidewalk ends.
Light
in the attic.
I've read those.
The Giving Tree.
The Giving Tree.
The name escaped me.
He did a wonderful adult book. He was one of the original publishers for Playboy, actually.
You know what's funny? When you said adult book, like I was like, are you talking about porn?
Yeah. He did a book, and it was called Uncle Shel's ABZs, A Primer for Adults. And it was basically the ABC book, but it was for adults. But for children,
okay.
so like it's you're the target audience,
right?
But it's supposed to be for the kids, okay. And so you know M is for money. Money is the green stuff that makes mommy and daddy fight,
right?
Go to mommy's purse and daddy's wallet, take all the green stuff, and send it to P.O. box.
It's a brilliant. It's hysterical.
A wonderful book.
Huh. Well, and a lot of these children's authors. I mean, today people almost take criticism for writing for both children and adults because you're not allowed to do both,
right?
Which is crap. Shel Silverstein, not a lot of people like that has been totally repressed. Dr. Seuss,
yeah,
wrote a lot of adult stuff. Roald Dahl wrote a lot of adult short stories. I actually got one of his omnibus and put it under my pillow and started reading it at night. And some of the stories are so fucked up. Oh, you already did it. It's okay.
Yeah, I did.
Some of the stories are so fucked up that I was having like whacked out dreams. I was like, this guy's messed up. I think I need to read his children's books before I go to bed from now on.
Turning that light on.
And then, of course, I look down, I've got the Wikipedia up, and it lists all of his different children's novels, adult novels, short stories, whatever else. And under children's poetry, one of it's called Dirty Beasts. So I say that, and I look down, and I see Dirty Beasts under children's poetry.
Nice.
Yeah, there's that. Anyway, yeah, Roald Dahl's amazing. Most children's authors, when you dig a little bit deeper, always dig a little bit deeper into children's authors, because chances are, if they write amazing children's stories, they probably write amazing adult stories, too.
Very true. And we've given you plenty of food for thought and a lot of books to go out and buy and read and enjoy. And
do yourself a favor.
And you can find all of their links on the website just to make your life a little easier.
Yep.
You can find us at on Twitter at the HHHH and on Facebook at
Facebook.com/thehalfhourhappyhour.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
But go to our website. We're going to start adding some new features on there. Keep in touch.
If you enjoy hearing us be idiots, you will totally love the features that we're adding soon. Just saying. More idiocy to come.
We'll call it a B-side.
Blooper reel might be more appropriate.
Yes, excellent.
I think we should just call it Epic Facepalm.
Yes. But we might make you search for it a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, there you go.
There you are. Little Easter egg action.
Yep, that might work.
Cool. Thank you for joining us this week, and we will see you again soon.
Scene? Question mark?